Hello, everyone. This is Sasha Latipova, due diligence for Trial Site News. Today I'm going to have a lengthy presentation. I don't have a guest, but I'm going to discuss a very important topic. And this will cover some material that I already addressed, but a lot of new material as well. I'm going to share my screen. And the topic of my presentation today is intent to harm. And I'm going to discuss evidence of conspiracy, which is not a theory, of U.S. Department of Defense, Health and Human Services, other government agencies, and other governments all over the world in collusion with pharmaceutical companies, a conspiracy to commit mass murder through bioterrorism and informational warfare operations worldwide. So let's review the totality of all evidence to date. I'm not going to cover all of these topics. I'm going to focus more on the organization and pseudo-legal structure of this crime. But just to recap, and I think many people will agree with me that the evidence is overwhelming, that there is an intent to harm people by the COVID-19 injections, so-called vaccines, and other nonsensical COVID response measures implemented in lockstep by all governments all over the world. For example, these injections are toxic by design. We know this. There has been extensive body of literature, studies, scientific discussions, evidence published on this matter. There are numerous mechanisms of injury built into the COVID-19 injections, most important one being that these shots are designed to make your cells attack themselves, make your cells express antigens that are toxic, spike proteins, and then create antibodies to attack the cells. So it trains your body to destroy itself, toxic by design. There are definitely no safety in these shots. There's horrific death and injury toll recorded in numerous data sets that are designed for pharmacovigilance, such as VAERS, VSAFE, Ultravigilance, Yellow Card, and so forth. And we know today there are millions of reports of injury, deaths, permanent disabilities, sadly, death in very young people, including children. There is no efficacy in these shots. In fact, we know there is negative efficacy, meaning that these shots make you more likely to get sick and die. For example, a very large study recently by Kaiser Permanente, which is a California insurer and a healthcare provider who forced all of their employees to get these shots and then studied those employees, 120,000 of them. They found that after about 3 months, these employees are much more likely to get COVID. There's extensive evidence of bad manufacturing of these products, and I covered it a lot in my own work. I know that there is a highly variable production of these shots. I've demonstrated it in many ways. We have documentation of this coming directly from the manufacturers and from regulators. They are not compliant with good manufacturing practices. And importantly, there is no enforcement of good manufacturing practices worldwide for these products. We also know that there is malignant government policy all over the place, and it's surprisingly consistent across all countries of the world. The governments all are lying, covering up, gaslighting of the injured, prosecute dissent and whistleblowers, especially when they're professionals like myself, or professionals like prominent doctors who are speaking against these measures. And there is definitely massive collusion with the media, who are all engaged in informational warfare and propaganda, and especially perverse financing. So the money flow is tremendous, and it's all funding this crime, funding compliance, funding doctors and nurses, vaccinators, universities, administrations, employers, government officials, funding them all to continue to commit this crime. The crime is very clear, and there is very clear intent to harm. Why there is no action by the regulators? That's a key question. Why, given all of this, nobody has stopped this? FDA did not recall the EUAs, the EUA did, FDA did not recall the products, no enforcement of GMP. Well, the answer why is because Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra, FDA Commissioner Robert Califf, are running the U.S. government's bioterrorism program jointly with U.S. Department of Defense and its Secretary Lloyd Austin, Department of Justice, Attorney General Merrick Garland, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla, Moderna CEO Stéphane Bancel, World Health Organization Tedros Ghebreyesus, and many other government and defense officials. So let's review the pseudo-legal structure of this crime. I'm going to cover U.S. primarily in this presentation. Many of these things apply worldwide, but I recommend international viewers and listeners who are interested in this topic to check the laws that are similar in your countries to what has been done here in the U.S., which I'm going to cover. I'm saying pseudo-legal because you cannot legalize a crime. Yet this is exactly what the U.S. government has done over many, many years. This goes back a lot of years. We're going to discuss that. And they made it on paper legal, and none of this is lawful because they are committing a crime. So to review the most recent key legislation, I'm going to rephrase or kind of rehash the analysis that Catherine Watt has done extensive research on and published on her Substack, which is called Bailey Week News. I highly, highly recommend everyone subscribe to her and read her work. It's an encyclopedia of law references, meticulously researched, going back years, describing how the structure was put in place and what it entails. But to just boil it down to some key pieces, the first one is the Emergency Use Authorization Law, which was put in place in 97 during Clinton administration. And this legislation gets rid of the FDA safety and efficacy regulations and allows FDA to issue emergency use authorizations for certain products, which, you know, they deem, you know, require it. Now, at the beginning, this was very limited and pretty strict sort of limitations as far as when it can be applied, and only limited only for a year. It needs to be renewed every year. And there are some conditions, pretty important conditions that exist for issuing the EUA, such as, for example, there are no other options for treatment available for that particular disease or condition, and a disease and condition is super desperate. But, you know, this was put in place in 97. The other transaction authority, while it existed since a long time, since the 60s, it was amended in 2015, and it enables Department of Defense to order undisclosed military prototypes from private manufacturers such as pharmaceutical companies. And finally, the last keystone of this is PREP Act, and it was amended shortly before this global pandemic or public health emergency in the U.S. was announced, and it specifically, very thoroughly exempts anyone participating in this program, in this activity, in this bioterrorism program, from any liability, from lawsuits, from injuries and deaths caused by these actions. The public health emergency was announced during Trump administration in 2020, and it has been extended since by Biden administration, and will be continued to be extended, even though there is no public health emergency and hasn't been one for a very long time. Actually, I can argue that there has never been a public health emergency in relation to this. But they will continue it because this is the keystone that holds all of this criminal structure together. So let's review first the other transaction authority, what it means. Other transaction authority, actually, it means other than, it's a catch-all definition, the catch-all category of contracting that was put in place to avoid all normally regulated ways of government contracting, such as contract, research grant, procurement, other modes of contracting that the government utilized until then, which were all regulated and subject to accountability. So this category of other allows government to not do any of that and to avoid regulation and accountability. And initially it was put in place in 1960s for NASA only, but now 11 government agencies are using it. BARDA, DOD, HHS, and NIH use OTAs extensively and funnel billions to private contractors for a very vaguely defined category of COVID countermeasures. We'll discuss this in more detail. This particular way of contracting shields private companies from government rights to taxpayer-funded IP, and this includes disclosures. And so this is very attractive to private companies that, you know, then they can get billions in government funding for the research and development activities for which they have no disclosure or sharing responsibilities anymore. And so these companies tend to reward those government officials with cushy jobs, positions on the boards of directors, you know, other means. And that's why we see the revolving door between FDA and pharmaceutical companies, for example. This explains it. The Department of Defense is also a big fan of OTAs, uses them extensively with hundreds and hundreds of suppliers and private companies. And they order specifically through this OTA method of contracting, they order very vaguely defined prototypes and demonstrations that are not subject to any regulatory scrutiny. What are the military prototype countermeasures? Well, as I said, they're extremely vaguely defined. Here's the language from the law. And it specifically says that DoD can carry out prototype projects that are directly relevant to enhancing the mission effectiveness of military personnel, supporting platform systems, components, or material proposed to be acquired or developed by the Department of Defense, or to improvement of the platform systems, components, materials used by the armed forces. So I read a lot of words, but they didn't say anything. They just said something that Department of Defense wants, and typically what they want is weapons, as far as I know. So you can very easily hide the weapons in this verbiage and just order it from private biopharmaceutical companies or chemical companies, or, you know, these can be biological, chemical, radiological, or nuclear. All of this can fall under these vaguely defined terms of things that Department of Defense needs. Also, when are the countermeasures deployed? That's a very interesting question. Well, it turns out that these countermeasures can be deployed at any time that HHS Secretary and HHS decides that they should be deployed. So it's utterly to the discretion of the Health and Human Services to declare public health emergency. And once they do that, based on no criteria at all, there's no standard which says, well, now we have pandemic or now we have epidemic. There are no standards. They used to exist, and now they don't exist anymore because they have been rephrased and reworded into the oblivion. So now it's really what HHS feels like. And generally what they feel like is what WHO tells them to feel like. And in this case, Tedros from WHO declared global pandemic based on 40 cases of COVID, 40 cases in 8 billion people. Okay. And then HHS runs and says, pandemic, declares public health emergency here in the United States. And once they do that, so that triggers the whole criminal structure to be clicked into place. And when it clicks into place, then the only criteria for deploying these vaguely defined countermeasures that Department of Defense somehow desperately wants is that the HHS secretary may issue emergency use authorization if he or she, in their sole capacity as HHS secretary, conclude that based on the totality of scientific evidence available, if available, so it doesn't have to be available, these products may be effective. That's the only standard. There's no other standard. They don't need to be proven safe. They don't need to be proven effective. It's just that they may be effective, and they may be effective based on known and potential benefits. They don't have to be proven, and known or potential risks. Also, they don't have to be proven. Risks don't have to be proven. So as you can see, it really is just open to anything that arbitrarily is decided by HHS and its secretary. And of course, the perpetrators of this crime, DOD, Pfizer agents, have now, we see they have ample means, motive, and opportunity through these OTA contracts to ensure that no evidence ever becomes available. And as we mentioned before, of course, we have huge media collusion to ensure that there is no evidence, suppression of evidence, censorship, deletions, deplatforming, hiding, and lying and obfuscation. Now all of this makes sense. The most critical and important component of this is this part of the law that's cited here that says that the use of emergency use authorization covered medical countermeasures, once designated as such by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, shall not be considered to constitute a clinical investigation. This is the most critical piece of this whole puzzle. Why the FDA is acting this way, why with all the overwhelming evidence, nothing has happened anywhere in the world. Nobody stopped these products. Nobody started any investigations. Why? Well, that's why, because they are not actually clinical and investigational products, meaning that they're not subject to any normal pharmaceutical regulatory rules. And that's why they're not, you know, countermeasures. For their vague definition, you can only say what they're not. And we definitively can say here that they are not pharmaceutical products. So when FDA goes on media and says, oh, you know, we reviewed COVID-19 vaccines rigorously and they're safe and effective, they're lying in many, many ways here. And the first way that they're lying is that they're actually talking about them as if they have regulatory authority over this matter. They don't. Vaccine development and approval, it could be a name for a movie or a theater production or a show. It's a performance art. There is no vaccine development and approval because these products are not pharmaceuticals. They're not vaccines. They're countermeasures under EUA, under public health emergency. They're not subject to any regulation, especially not pharmaceutical regulation. So this, by the way, explains the use, the very strange use of word demonstration in DOD contracts for these so-called vaccines. They are really demonstrated, the performance art is a demonstration. And clinical trials were not ordered by the DOD and HHS contracts as they're not possible for countermeasures. You cannot do a clinical trial for something that's not, that cannot be an investigational clinical product. Also, the good manufacturing practice compliance was not ordered by these contracts because it is not possible. It's not a pharmaceutical product. Legally, there are no clinical trial subjects or investigators, and therefore there has never been informed consent for these things. And what FDA is really doing, they're impersonating the regulators and lying to the public. I'm not saying all 15,000 employees of the FDA are aware of this, but I know that a few at the top are really have been briefed and they know what they're doing. So they're impersonating the regulators and they're lying to their own employees who have been pushed to the limit and in fact to FDA reviewers during this sort of warp speed review and approval, which was really a theater, took it so seriously that they committed suicide because of overwork and stress and have been pushed to the limit. So they're in fact acting against their own employees and they're committing a crime against all of us, including many, 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 many people who work at the FDA and HHS. So here are some examples of key examples. I can continue talking about it for another hour, but some key examples that show that FDA really does not regulate these countermeasures. And this makes sense why they're behaving this way. First of all, none of the regulators, neither FDA nor EMA, no regulators in the world, know what protein is actually expressed by these mRNA injections. So Pfizer and Moderna and others are claiming that they're, you know, injecting you with this mRNA code, and then your cells are producing this the spike protein, the target antigen. And specifically, the first products were approved for the Wuhan, so-called Wuhan spike protein. And the Wuhan spike protein has been characterized, although I question that characterization because it's largely computer modeling, but at least, you know, there's some materials that exist for it. And they're saying, well, it's, here's the structure. It's folded this way. Here's the molecular weight. So it's 140 kilodaltons. So that's what's supposed to be expressed theoretically by this mRNA injection. However, in the documents that are available, there is no care from manufacturers. These documents have been leaked from EMA, but there are some others. There have been no characterization of the spike protein that is actually expressed after injection with, let's say, Pfizer mRNA shot or Moderna mRNA shot. Neither manufacturers nor any other third-party researchers, and largely because they don't have access to the test material, have shown that human cell lines, any other cell lines, actually produce the spike that is, you know, related to this Wuhan spike. What Pfizer has shown to the European Medicines Agency is that the spike protein produced by the synthetic mRNA that they have in their shot is 180 kilodaltons. So already it's substantially larger than the Wuhan spike. So definitely it's different than the Wuhan spike. But they have not characterized it in any other way. Now here's a piece of the chemistry manufacturing control submission to the European Medicines Agency produced by Pfizer. And this is from the leaked documentation, which I have and other researchers have. It only shows that there was lack of characterization of spike protein. And it also shows that the European Medicines Agency reviewers were very upset about this. And I totally understand why, because this is a very, very big deal. It's critical. And the manufacturer is hiding this information or doesn't have it or cannot produce it. They noted this as a severe deficiency of characterization section, that there is no biological characterization of presented and that the mode of action is not described. So the manufacturer is claiming a certain mode of action. So they're saying you were going to make your cells produce this antigen against this particular type of a virus, but they have never actually shown it. So how are we supposed to believe them? How is regulators supposed to believe them? And this is a requirement. It's a must have for any pharmaceutical product. If you're making a claim, you have to demonstrate it, and they haven't demonstrated. Also further, it says that even though full biological characterization is not possible to perform on drug substance, well, okay, so this should have been a showstopper right there. If it's not possible to do, then you cannot make this product. You cannot inject people with it. And certainly you cannot mandate it on every man, woman, and child in the world. So this is a huge deal that has never been properly covered. I'm borrowing slides from my friend and a really a great expert and in pharmaceuticals and regulations that has done extensive review of these documents, Maria Gucci. She's based in Canada. But this needs to be broadcast all over the place. And this needs to be communicated to people clearly, that the manufacturers have never shown that this product does what they claim it's supposed to do. They've never shown it to the regulators. Regulators noted this as a severe deficiency. In fact, it became specific obligation, a condition of the conditional marketing approval, which was issued in December 2020 for this product. This obligation, while, you know, negotiated, agreed to by Pfizer as a condition of their conditional marketing authorization has never been met. It wasn't met as of December 2021. And in February 2022, EMA just gave up and said, well, I guess it's fine. So we still don't know whether this product does what the manufacturer claims to do. And this little table here, it's directly from the Pfizer document from their submission to EMA at the end of 2020. And it shows this test was called Western Blot, where they evaluated the expression of a protein by weight. So not structure, nothing characterized as far as the sequences of structure, but just simply the weight of this spike protein expressed in this HEK293 cell line, which is, by the way, aborted fetal cell line, if anyone is interested. And as you can see, these black lines that go across the top line, those are the expressed proteins, and they're all greater than 140 kilodaltons. They're around 180 and above. So this is they express a bigger spike, different from Wuhan, and we don't know whether it's a similar or different or what, you know, what is it doing. And by the way, the next question is whether it's consistently expressed in the cells of a single individual that gets injected, consistently expressed in all cell lines where this product ends up, not just the muscle cell, but liver cells. Maybe it's one type of a protein in the muscle cell and a different type of protein in the liver cell. This also needs to be characterized. And how is it different across individuals, across genders, races, ages? All of this needs to be characterized. It has never been. The next thing that has never been addressed is another important component of this product is the lipid nanoparticles, or the lipids. Regulators do not know anything about the proprietary lipids, and because Pfizer never told them. Again, this is a humongous showstopper. This is not allowed by the GMP. This is not allowed by the regulatory review rules. Yet somehow, you know, while the regulators wrote that they're disagreeing with this and they have objections, there was no action. So nobody stopped these products. These products just rolled out as is. So we're talking about proprietary lipids. They are, for Pfizer, they're ALC-0159 and ALC-0315. This is just numbers. We don't know anything about them. They're not pharmaceutical grade, meaning that they're not characterized in any way. They're completely proprietary. And so in those cases, if you have something completely proprietary, novel, you just invented it yourself, then you also need to invent the tests, the assays that characterize them, so that you can demonstrate that you can produce what you're claiming you're producing, and you can produce it consistently and through all the batches, all the injections. And so that there is pharmaceutical grade impurity that you yourself can demonstrate through a variety of assays and tests. And this hasn't been done. Now, Pfizer did not include those assays, those validated assays. And the steps of the manufacturing were not described and not known, still not known. And the pharmacology of these lipids is therefore also not known. For any other normal product, this would be a showstopper immediately until it's resolved. And this has never been addressed. And billions of people are being injected with this. So let's continue. Let's review the organizational structure of this crime, of this criminal cartel. How are they operating it? Well, before we get in there, let me introduce you to a very useful framework. It's actually useful in many aspects of your life when you're dealing with a complex organization, such as the government, academia, your employer, if you're working for a large company. How do you understand the true roles in the organization? Oftentimes, organizational chart, which is just sort of standard pyramid structure, doesn't tell you much. It just tells you titles and who reports to whom formally. But the critical piece of looking at the complex organization and trying to understand, well, how do I interact with it? How do I get results from it? You need to understand the managerial roles that exist in this organization and who, which part of the organization, who specifically plays what role. And in your mind, you should divide them into three general categories, which is interpersonal, informational, and decisional. So they're progressing from publicly visible but unimportant to invisible, often very deeply hidden, but highly, highly important and consequential. So the interpersonal ones, generally, we're talking about a figurehead or some sort of a visible leader who maybe, you know, maybe everybody knows their name, like Albert Bourla, but those are just ceremonial roles. And while, of course, he is a criminal and should be indicted for this crime, but, you know, I assure you, he is not very consequential to this organization. He was put in place. He is completely unimpressive as far as intelligence or experience. And he's just a talking head. He walks around, represents Pfizer. So he's a spokesperson. Now, there are usually in the middle somewhere, there are information control, information flow roles. We'll come back to them later. But the really, really important ones are the decision makers. So who are the real decision makers? And the way to recognize them is typically those are the roles that are in charge of the money, of allocation of the money, decisions on the contracts, negotiations with other external parties, and resolution of various internal and external conflicts. So those are the real decisional roles. And typically they also set the policy for the entire organization. So with this framework in mind, let's assess the structure, organizational structure of the complex pharma government cartel that we're dealing with. First thing to realize, this was reported long ago, but I don't think it got enough attention, and I don't think many people are aware of this. But in the United States, the National Security Council set the COVID policy. It wasn't the HHS, but it was National Security Council. In fact, previously, since 2018, at least, we had a pandemic action plan. It was called PANCAP. And that pandemic action plans from 2018 stated that HHS was actually in charge of pretty much everything. And that kind of makes sense, because if you have a public health emergency event, then it's a public health agency that typically has those plans. And they did, you know, HHS did have a pandemic preparedness plans, which did not include stupid things like lockdowns and would not mandate masks on everybody. So those were more reasonable and more normal and more science-based actions that were recommended in those plans. Now, when 2020 came around, all of a sudden this PANCAP plan was adapted. And now we have a new version that tells a completely different story. In that version, the National Security Council is in charge of the policy. So they're the decisional role for this. So first let's address what is National Security Council. National Security Council is an advisory body to the President of the United States. It's an executive forum for foreign policy and national security. It does not include public health related agencies, typically not involved with those matters. The regular attendees of NSC are Vice President, Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of Defense, Assistant to the President on National Security Affairs, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Director of National Intelligence. So we see it's mostly defense and intelligence and security type of representatives. And they are, so now, all of a sudden, since 2020, they're in charge of COVID policy. That's how strange it is, because we are told it's a virus. Naturally evolved first, you know, they were trying to pretend it's a naturally evolved virus. Of course, it was very clear from the start. It was some sort of a bioterror toxic agent. But nevertheless, so we were led to believe that this is a health emergency. It's a virus. It's a pandemic. Yet, national security, defense, and intelligence agencies are in charge of the policy for this thing. And here's the organizational chart from the new version, adapted version of pandemic action plan. And here's the one, the part where it says that the policy set by National Security Council, this is the decisional role. Also, interestingly, it includes weapons of mass destructions, bats, I don't know what that means, and resilience. And resilience is a very, another vague term, but means a lot of things. And the government is trying to drive this agenda of we have to constantly be prepared for different pandemics and different attacks and all sorts of things. And of course, that just means give us a lot of money and a lot of power and remove a lot of rights from individuals. But in any case, so these are the things that reside under National Security Council. Now, we also see here that HHS and CDC are involved, but they're involved in operations and coordination and information. They're not involved in the policy, which is, you know, setting strategy for how you would respond to a public health emergency. Now, what is, who wasn't put in as in charge as a lead federal agency, or rather not in charge, but in charge of the operations, policy set by NSC, the operations head all of a sudden is FEMA. And again, that was another surprise and another first and unprecedented. And that was because President Trump declared nationwide emergency under the Stafford Act, which was never used before. And this authorizing assistance administered by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Then President Trump notified then FEMA Administrator Peter Gaynor that the agency would assume leadership of the federal pandemic response effort. So this was the first known instance of FEMA serving in the role of public health incident. And that was unprecedented. Well, so that immediately suggests to me that FEMA is a figurehead role, that ceremonial, visible, but unimportant role. And the HHS is in the information and propaganda role. So we'll come back to HHS later. Let's look at FEMA. Skipped one slide. So FEMA is a figurehead. HHS is information and propaganda. And then we have this Operation Warp Speed that's brought in, to develop these, COVID injections, so-called vaccines and other countermeasures such as therapeutics and other, you know, diagnostics and all sorts of things under this COVID countermeasure cover, and they're supposed to be working together. So here the Operation Warp Speed advertises them as working together and collaboratively, but actually the actual organization structure shows something a little bit different. And here's the organization structure that was shared publicly in October 2020 at the Vaccines and Related Biologicals meeting, advisory committee meeting, and where there were representatives of all these agencies, you know, discussing the pandemic response. So they have discussed this particular organizational structure for themselves. Here the org chart is turned on its side. So the top of the org chart is on the right hand side. And you can see that at the very top of the org chart, we have Chief Operating Officer as the Department of Defense. And the HHS is only advisor. So what they're saying, Chief Science Advisor. So, okay, it makes it very clear that the organization in charge of this whole thing is the Department of Defense. And HHS, while they're working collaboratively, are only in the advisory role. Also, we see that this whole top part of the chart has the government agencies. And as we know, NSC said in the policy, DOD is Chief Operating Officer. We also have BARDA. We'll come back to it in a minute. BARDA is an authority, or Research and Development Authority. So all of this group here, governmental group led by DOD, is clearly in charge. And then the third level down includes all of the pharmaceutical and medical device and so forth distribution companies, vendors, who are not in charge. They're just the third level on this org chart, but they're very happy, I assure you, because they're getting billions and billions of dollars exempt from all liability as long as they just follow the orders of the Department of Defense. So in this structure also, curiously, we have the government, specifically Department of Defense through BARDA and other government agencies and participants from HHS and NIH. So they're all together deciding on the key pieces of how these products are going to be developed, such as clinical trial design, protocols, manufacturing, distribution, supply production and distribution. So how the supply chain is going to be assembled, operations and analysis, security, infrastructure, legal. So they're providing legal cover for all of this, clearly, public affairs and so meaning communications and lying to the public. So they're taking that on as well. So government does everything, that, you know, all the key components. Driver of all decisions and how the things are going to be implemented. And pharmas and other companies are just following the orders. So the question is here, who is really developing and manufacturing these injections? And in fact, there were many reports I found, very good reports from 2020, stating this, you know, stating the same concern, raising the same concern that, all of this Operation Warp Speed looks very much more like army than science. That especially in the more detailed organization chart, turns out 60 military officials, are in the leadership roles, including at least four generals who are, involved in the leadership Operation Warp Speed. And many of whom have never worked in healthcare or vaccine development. And this was represented initially as just the logistics, you know, army is just doing logistics, but, actually, you know, turns out that they were involved in roles completely other than logistics. So as I've seen, as I've shown on the previous chart, it's not just the logistics, it's pretty much everything. Also turns out that 2/3 of approximately 90 leaders on that org chart were employed by the Department of Defense, and only 1/3 of them was not. By the way, so a person like Deborah Birx, turns out she's not an HHS employee. She was from the National Security. Raises many, many questions, but clearly points that Department of Defense, 2/3 of leadership and a lot of manufacturing and production belongs to them. Here's another chart from the same meeting, in October 2020, where Operation Warp Speed and BARDA discussing their vaccine manufacturing portfolio. So they're discussing that, you know, they have all this infrastructure already put in place, which is here represented on the right-hand side. They're calling it vaccine supporting efforts. But actually, by the size of it, by the duration of how long it's been in place, which goes back to many, many years, contracts are showing at least to 2012, but many of them go back way before that, especially Emergent BioSolutions, which is circled here. There are key, even BARDA established key manufacturing centers, which is one of them is Emergent. There's another one. It's here. It's called Ology, but now it's been expanded and rebranded into Resilience. It's not, you know, interesting name. We've discussed it before. It's called Resilience, but this is a ostensibly private company with deep, deep connections to the Department of Defense, with a lot of board memberships affiliated and so forth, funded lavishly, that has bought up manufacturing facilities from a bunch of pharmaceutical companies and now is building up this humongous capacity to manufacture various types of biological products. They're calling them vaccines and other biologics. Not clear exactly what they're doing, but here they're prominently featured as a key manufacturing center, so-called supporting vaccine efforts. They also have academic institutions. One of these manufacturing centers at the Texas A&M University. I know they're specifically involved in Novavax vaccine development, but maybe others. Emergent, by the way, was the manufacturer for AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson for a while, and then they failed FDA inspection, and that manufacturing was moved, but they're still manufacturing for many other, their manufacturing never stopped, in fact, and was never remedied. So all of this has been put in place for, as I said, many years, established defense contractors manufacturing ostensibly flu vaccines, but, you know, they were calling it pan-influenza vaccine manufacturing capacity in some contracts. And then on the left-hand side, they're saying, well, these are the vaccine makers. Well, indeed, they're not really vaccine makers because, they didn't have the required capacity. The capacity that was ordered on a short order was impossible to fulfill without using this established defense contracting infrastructure, which is on the right hand side. So, and in fact, I found a lot of truth in these presentations. If you pay attention and you read the words carefully. So as you can see on the left hand side under vaccines, pretty much all of them are using this word demo. So we have Johnson & Johnson manufacturing demo, Sanofi manufacturing demo, AstraZeneca demo, Novavax demo, Pfizer demo. So these are demonstrations, meaning performance art, meaning they're just cover. On the right-hand side, this is the real manufacturing capacity, which was put in place for a long time and existed for a long time. So let's quickly... let me switch to the browser, and I'm going to briefly talk about BARDA. Let's reshare. Let's look at what is BARDA. Here's BARDA's website, and well, by the way, the website itself says medicalcountermeasures.gov, so that's the website address. BARDA is Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. So they're claiming that they are supporting, coordinating, and working collaboratively with the industry to advance certain products. Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, BARDA, within the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, provides an integrated, systematic approach to the development of the necessary vaccines, drugs, therapies, and diagnostic tools for public health medical emergencies, such as chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear accidents, incidents, and attacks, pandemic influenza, and emerging infectious diseases. So they're saying that they are helping to develop, together with private pharmaceutical industry, necessary drugs, vaccines, and therapies. And the question is, well, why is this? Why does this require government intervention so much? The argument has always been, well, these are not really profitable for pharmaceutical companies. They don't typically invest in these because there is really no market for it unless there is an emergency, and so the government needs to do this. Okay, well, maybe that's an argument. I don't know, but notice what so BARDA says. We're working with a lot of companies. We're doing all these things. So here their activities, their core services. So they assist in the development. You know, they funnel a lot of money. So they give grants to pharmaceutical companies, or they give contracts to pharmaceutical companies to develop certain things. Okay, fine. So for example, if there is a particular radionuclear preparation that doesn't have a market normally, only has a market during the time of war, maybe there is an argument to say, Okay, yeah, government should provide some sort of financing and contracting and work with the supplier to stock this kind of thing. Okay, so that's what they're doing. They're saying chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear issues, influenza, contract management, innovation. So yeah, they have scientists, they can work with pharma scientists, they can work with academic scientists. Also seems like, okay, detection, division research of innovation and ventures. Ventures meaning they also can provide funding in the form of investment. All of this looks wonderful to me. What I don't see here is that they are a regulatory authority in any way. And I don't expect them to be, because this is like an accelerator. This is really looks to me like a government run accelerator / venture investment / some sort of innovation center. Okay. They don't look to me like a regulatory body. So they're not a replacement for FDA, even though they sit within Health and Human Services in the same, you know, government sector. They are not a regulator of pharmaceuticals. And so we need to be very, very clear about that. Who is doing what? But let's go back to my presentation. And here we are. BARDA is saying, well, we're doing all this. Okay, great. And we're ordering demos from these companies. So meaning that this is the cover for this real manufacturing happening with established defense contractors. And I need to reshare. Also, from the same presentation by BARDA, at the same meeting, we have this brilliant slide. So BARDA likes to congratulate themselves on being super innovative. And in this case, they have invented something truly astounding, specifically in relation to these so-called vaccines, injectables. They're saying that they're going to compress the normally long and very rigorous and burdensome research and development program for the vaccines. As you know, it takes up to 10 years to develop a good vaccine, if that such a thing exists, you know, make up your own mind. But in any case, if you want to follow the regulations, it takes 7 to 10 years to accomplish all the steps that are required, including preclinical assessment, then followed by early phase clinical, late phase clinical, then approval, and also establishing good manufacturing practice in your factories. That also takes a tremendous amount of time and effort. Now, what BARDA says, we're so brilliant, guys, because we can compress this all, because, you know, the key thing here is we can do large-scale manufacturing in parallel with clinical trials. Well, you know, that sounds really interesting to me, because this is actually a violation of good manufacturing practices, which is Title 21 in Code of Federal Regulation. And that Code of Federal Regulation was specifically established to avoid this exact thing from happening, to prevent this exact thing from happening. It is not possible to manufacture safe products before safety is properly tested. So the BARDA is extremely proud of themselves because they break the law, and they accelerate their development by breaking the law because they're government and they think that they're allowed to do that. Well, maybe the government can break the laws. They're also claiming, well, these are platforms. And you know what? There is no platform in pharmaceuticals. In fact, again, the same CFR 21 and also FDA's own guidances that they publish for the industry, for the private people, private companies that are not part of the government. So those guidances say specifically that you can claim you have a platform, but anything that comes off of this platform, you have to test separately. The same regulation, by the way, exists for, you know, car manufacturers. Ford has a, you know, has 150 platform for trucks and, or just a platform for trucks. And that includes different versions of them. F-150, F-250, F-350. Those are all coming off a platform, but each one of them has to be still tested separately. In fact, each car has to be tested. So, the platform does not exempt anyone in any industry from testing safety for the specific implementation of that platform. Yet BARDA said, hey, you know, we are so brilliant. We can eliminate the laws just like that, snap of a finger, and then we can accelerate this development and look at us. Here we are, Operation Warp Speed. So that's how actually these very reckless and dangerous products get on the market, because the government is doing it. They're also, as we've reviewed before, we assured ourselves that BARDA is not a regulatory agency in the United States or anywhere else. Yet, here we are, just a few weeks ago, November 15th, of 2022, BARDA was running a so-called Industry Day event. And this is, you know, sorry, a little bit blurry screenshot from one of their presentations where, again, they were giddy and congratulating themselves on accomplishments in 2022, that they have tested over 600 million COVID vaccine doses and over 23 million of COVID therapeutic doses, and tested and basically for release and acceptance. And that gave me a pause and a few of my colleagues a pause, and this needs to be investigated. Why is BARDA taking on the role of the regulator? It is the role of the regulator in the United States, which is FDA specifically, to test batches and releases of vaccine products. And they have done so historically for all vaccines, and for seasonal flu vaccines, they test each batch and release each batch individually in the United States. And there are records of how many batches were released. And also the test records must be available. Here we have BARDA claiming that they have performed this role, not the FDA. So again, why is a government military accelerator taking on the role of the regulator in the United States? But that just proves you a few things, that the FDA does not regulate these products. They are not testing them. The BARDA claims that they are. So next, let's look at the money flow. And when we want to understand the real drivers of decisions in any organization, we need to look at who is in charge of allocating the money. I have limited information on this, but there's some information available through contracts that have been released for the so-called COVID countermeasures. First of all, again, let's look at the BARDA slides. And this is from a year before that last slide that I showed. And they were sharing this again, congratulating themselves on such a success. Look how many partners and stakeholders we have. So they basically have hundreds and hundreds of companies that they are giving money to. And by giving money to and absolving them of many regulations, obviously they're controlling a huge part of the pharmaceutical industry this way. That's the money part. Also, turns out that BARDA has done this for years, going back to 2007. And look, this is increasing and increasing more with every year. And they're congratulating themselves. We hear they're saying 61. I think on the website it says now 67 FDA approvals, licenses, and clearances. And, you know, by the way, 67 is a very large number for FDA approvals. Even in the heyday of the pharmaceutical, private pharmaceutical industry, somewhere around the 90s, early 2000s, having something like 40 drug approvals a year for the entire industry in the United States, and that was considered a successful year. So here, BARDA is claiming a huge chunk of the approvals over time, and they're increasing, as you can see. They're claiming that their early investments paved the way for federal COVID response success. And look at the amounts of money that have been awarded. 400 million here, another 500 million there, a billion here, a billion there. And they cranked out just in 1 year, throwing this shower of money from the helicopter. They have cranked out a bunch of demonstration projects. There, look at this, commercial scale manufacturing, demo, commercial scale manufacturing, another demo, another demo. So all of these miracle so-called products, they're not actually products, they're demonstrations for a lot of money. So spending 500 million to a couple of billion a piece, we have very, very expensive demos bought by the United States government, distributed by BARDA. And here, BARDA again, bragging about how much money exactly they have funneled through this mechanism. We see 97 products supported. They said it's a huge number. And the total of $47.5 billion in R&D spend. To put this in perspective, the entire U.S. pharmaceutical industry, pharmaceutical companies, spend $107 billion a year on R&D. So BARDA accounts for around roughly half of this spend. So now this gives me a very big pause. So what was claimed to be these niche, small, but important products, such as the radiological, biological defense products that are otherwise not profitable and the companies would not invest in them. And so government just needs to help them out here and, you know, just buy some things for stock. Well, turns out they control the entire pharmaceutical industry, because if you have one buyer that spends 50% of the R&D spend in the entire industry, well, guess what? They control the entire industry. So my conclusion here is that in the United States, we do not have a private pharmaceutical manufacturing industry anymore. We have a government-controlled pharmaceutical industry, and specifically government defense-controlled pharmaceutical industry that funnels tremendous amount of money, and this half avoids all the regulation. So you have half of the industry that gets free money essentially to do whatever they like without following any rules, and the other half that is privately funded has to comply with incredible amount of regulation. So I give it another year or two, we will have none of the private sector left over, because you cannot possibly compete with this kind of thing. And here's how the money were distributed specifically in relation to these so-called COVID countermeasures. This is a screenshot from a collection of about 400 contracts that became available through freedom of information or through shareholder disclosures. And a full list is available here at the, I published the link. But all of these contracts, as you can see, have circled. They are all DOD. So every single one of the, you know, category, and here's a company, and then what it was for. So for example, AstraZeneca here vaccine, as you can see, they're all DOD. And in some cases it's parallel DOD. So AstraZeneca has both a collection of DOD contracts and then in parallel HHS and BARDA contracts. But pretty much obviously everything is controlled by the DOD. So this tremendous amount of money, according to BARDA, $47 billion, was distributed through these kinds of contracts and managed. So they're not even directly managed by the government. They're managed through this government management entity. It's called Advanced Technology International. And their role is to manage several consortia. So this Advanced Technology International gets money funneled through them and then distributed through these contracts to these companies. And by the way, Robert Kudlick, which was at the time Assistant Secretary for Pandemic Preparedness and Response under Trump, personally controlled and signed off which company gets what money. Imagine that power to allocate, you know, billions and billions of dollars. That same person kind of like led the update to the PREP Act to make sure that it's completely ironclad and bulletproof so that nobody can ever, ever sue any one of these companies or anybody associated with this for any injury or liability. Good job. And then he also is an ex-lobbyist for Emergent BioSolutions, which is a defense manufacturer I mentioned before, and also got cushy contracts for Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, and did an extremely sloppy job for them manufacturing those products. So for anyone who is interested to read these contracts, you can go to this link and you will find them and you can download them. So what is Advanced Technology International? It calls itself a nonprofit company that organizes consortia of public, private, and academic organizations that perform research and development on behalf of the U.S. government. So they are a management organization for U.S. government, and they manage consortia. Majority of their work is for the Department of Defense, vast majority, for things like weapons manufacturing, metal castings, forging, ship production, and technology aimed at countering weapons of mass destruction. Here's the screenshot from the ATI. Looks very healthcare to me. They're saying that they're accelerating impact. Very interesting with the machine gun. Also, of course, they're using this other transaction authorities that they claim that they're experts in this other transaction authority, how to do it, how to manufacture all these things without any regulations. It looks great to me. ATI manages two health-related consortia. So there's, you know, health in quotation marks, because these are all dual purpose and can be used for weapons or maybe health. One of them is called Medical Technology Enterprise Consortium, MTEC. It operates on behalf of the U.S. Army Medical Research and Development Command, and includes technologies for gene editing, nanotechnology, telehealth solutions, artificial limbs, brain implants, if you would like one. Maybe it will be mandated for your employer. Currently developing a wearable device to diagnose COVID-19 before symptoms appear, so they can tag you as a dangerous individual carrying COVID. Sounds really like a Chinese practice to me. Medical CBRN Defense Consortium is advanced development efforts to support the Department of Defense medical, pharmaceutical, and diagnostic requirements to counter chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear threat agents. Okay, so while these are health-related, both of these consortia are for Army and Department of Defense, and they enable prototype technologies for therapeutic medical countermeasures targeting viral, bacterial, biological toxins, or targets of interest to the Department of Defense, including the development of vaccines. Here's this CBRN consortium. This is their webpage. You can also go and check it out. They are really dual purpose weapons makers for chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear. They're currently, well, this says 316, now it's 318 or so members. 87% of them are non-traditional. So these are just haven't been established defense contractors before, but they're all contracting again through this magical other transaction authority mechanism. And these are, again, this is a screenshot. You can see all the members. This includes a huge number of large, small academic and nonprofit companies. This consortium, together with Advanced Technologies International, awarded Pfizer the contracts for the COVID countermeasures. And so here we have the base agreement, the transactions agreement. So they contracted with Pfizer. This consortium contracted with Pfizer, and ATI is managing it under other transaction authority. And specifically in the consortium technical direction letter, so the direction letter is kind of like a scope of work. What are you supposed to do for this contract with these billions of dollars that we're giving you? Well, it specifically said that the scope of work is large-scale vaccine manufacturing demonstration. Again, we have this use of interesting use of word demonstration. And in fact, Pfizer stated this exact same fact as in the motion to dismiss Brooke Jackson's lawsuit, False Claims Act, under False Claims Act, saying that, well, we didn't defraud the government by doing these fraudulent clinical studies. We did nothing wrong because we were only ordered to provide a demonstration. A demonstration, by definition, is fake. Okay, it's not a real deal. So that was their argument to the court. And technically, they're correct. I read that letter. It does say exactly this. You can read it too. And here's a screenshot from Moderna contract. It's just showing this clause, this PrEP Act clause. It's actually standard in all of these contracts. And this says specifically that according to the PrEP Act, everyone involved in this contract implementation, anybody touching this product, delivering it, you know, administering it, they're all exempt. They're all covered person under PrEP Act. In fact, anyone, regardless of where they work, or who they employed by, when they're performing work under this contract and administering these, distributing these injections, they're considered HHS employees for the purposes of this. And that makes them totally covered. It's like their government, okay? Even if they're working in your local pharmacy. And then it provides immunity from any and all liability. And also the last sentence of this clause is very interesting because it says that the items and technology covered by this contract are being developed for both civil and military applications. So this is, and this, as I said, this is a standard clause in all of these contracts. So in conclusion, what I would like to say about this, these so-called vaccines, COVID-19 injections, are indeed weapons and they intend to harm. So DoD had established these manufacturing and surge capacity since at least 2012, huge capacity to do this. There are millions of square feet. They established the whole supply chain, staff, raw materials, assays, kits, manufacturing equipment, logistics, systems, and so forth, so that this can be just switched on, when you need it. When WHO tells them to declare the pandemic, they go and declare pandemic and they immediately switch on this capacity. Imagine if really this wasn't in place and we have a global pandemic, or anything else happens, and let's, for example, forget about pharmaceutical. If I need to manufacture a million new cars in 6 months, and I go to Ford Motor Company and I tell them, here's, you know, a few billion dollars. Can you deliver, you know, these a million cars for me in 6 months or 9 months? Ford will say, no, we can't do that because we don't have raw materials. We don't have staff. We don't have logistics. We don't have manufacturing lines. We don't even have parking space to put them all in. So how would you do that if you didn't have this already built for this specific purpose since a long time ago? And that's exactly what happened here. The Department of Defense has established this, has made this happen, build all this, and then they just switched it on demand. Then they started showering money on everyone to shut them up, to make them happy, and to make them fall in line quickly. That's exactly what happened. They just basically rolled up a whole bunch of money to the pharma companies and said, here is $10 billion, Pfizer, for this contract. You just need to, you know, follow the orders. Just do what we tell you to do and use these suppliers that we have prepared for you. Put your name on it and just ship us doses, lots of doses, up to 500 million doses. And Pfizer said, yeah, sure. And that's what they're doing. Pfizer did not have the capacity to fulfill this contract, not even close. They could never do it by themselves. So that's why they are using all these existing suppliers. In the contracts, the government ensured that there would be no accountability at all. They're just saying the manufacturer will make reasonable effort, whatever that means. They are, however, very micromanaging as far as the operations and the fact that Pfizer doesn't have any direct relationship with the FDA, for example. Pfizer doesn't design their own clinical trials, their own protocols, doesn't select their own vendors. The vendors are directly, such as ICON, the clinical research provider, is directly contracted by the DOD. So we see that this relationship is not at all arm's length. It's not, you know, here's money and you need to provide me these products to these specifications. It's here's money and here's follow all my orders and I'm going to be in charge of all of this. And also, government, Department of Defense specifically is in charge of the distribution. These products are not put into the traditional pharma distribution chain, which is accountable, responsible, traceable, and auditable. No, it's all black box operations. So the products get shipped by contract to the Department of Defense. They are then distributed by the Department of Defense, even if they're using third-party distributors under PrEP Act, they're all government employees. And this is civil and military application. And by the way, the government owns this product throughout the supply chain. Just a brief note on how this is done outside of the United States. Well, they're doing exactly the same thing, but they're just basically waiving any regulatory importation, drug rules, or good manufacturing practice or compliance rules through predatory contract clauses. And they are, in fact, also removing national sovereignty for purposes of liability and prohibit changing of the national laws in regard to liability. And they also prohibit internationally or anywhere, actually, independent vial testing of these products. And here's how they're, you know, here's the proof that this product is owned by the Department of Defense, by the U.S. government throughout. This is a section from a contract published on the CDC, contract with vaccination centers. It says specifically that the product has been purchased by the United States government, but in the contract, it actually says DOD, and it's owned, remains U.S. government property until vaccine is administered into somebody. So here's the complete picture. The Department of Defense is largely in charge of it. They are making these products. They're designing these products. They're running the clinical trials. They're paying everyone for it. They're taking possession of these products into the black box distribution system. They're distributing them throughout. They're administering them throughout this whole system. They own it until it gets into the person. And that's why I'm saying these are weapons and they are intended to harm. And this explains why this hasn't been stopped, hasn't been recalled, hasn't been investigated. FDA is doing nothing about it. They're just pretending to regulate them and lying to the public about it. So this concludes my presentation for today. And for additional resources and summaries of evidence, you can go to these links. You can post the slide and, you know, copy it. And I highly recommend especially the research and investigation by Catherine Watt on Bailiwick News Substack. Please share this presentation and put some comments and questions, and I'll try to address them. Thank you very much for your attention.